Hey folks, Jared here. Thanks for tuning back into Sea Control. If you haven't heard, we brought in some new hosts, and our first new host, Andrea Howard, dropped her first episode last week, interviewing Dr. Stephen Goff about opportunities for cooperation between the Coast Guard and the Space Force. This week, we've got the team behind the 2019 study, Bursting the Bubble, Russian A2AD in the Baltic, and the 2020 study, Beyond Bursting Bubbles, Robert Dalzio and Michael Janssen. Please emotionally prepare yourself to hear me mispronounce Michael's name seven different ways. I definitely should have taken him up on his offer to just refer to him as Michael. As a reminder, all views expressed are our own and not representative of any institution with which we might be otherwise associated. As always, we want to advertise and strongly recommend our friends in the SimSec Podcast Network and our second podcast feed, The Bilge Pumps. You can find Alex, Drac, Jamie, and a pile of empty iron brew bottles on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and wherever else you download your podcasts. It's a more low-key, slightly less serious approach to current events in the maritime domain and naval history. Check them out wherever you download. This week, they're taking you back to ancient Rome. With that, I'll turn it over to Kimber's men.
You're listening to Sea Control, hosted by the Center for International Maritime Security.
Aloha, shipmates, and welcome back aboard Sea Control. Today I'm joined by two of the authors of one of my favorite works and its sequel. We'll get into their work in a second here, but first I'd like to welcome Robert Dalzio and Michael Janssen to the program. Gentlemen, thanks for agreeing to join me. Before we talk about your work, I'd like to give each of you the opportunity to introduce yourself to our listeners. So, Robert, would you mind starting?
Okay, I'm somewhat of a veteran here. I've been doing political military affairs for the Swedish government for 30 years. And whatever the topic has been, the flavor of the year since Crimea, but we never forget Russia. So, and especially since Crimea, it's been a lot Russia related. And I have a background as a reserve officer in the Coast Artillery, which is now sadly defunct.
Thank you and welcome. And Michael, would you please tell us a little bit about your background?
Yeah, sure. I've been working at the Swedish Defense Research Agency for 7 years, so I'm not a newcomer anymore, maybe, but I'm not as seasoned as Robert. Like him, I'm a PhD in political science from Uppsala, former Fulbright scholar at Georgetown University. I've been working, well, like most of us, on different topics, but I've fairly recently come into sort of conventional military studies. Before that, I did a lot of civil wars and terrorist studies and that sort of.
Well, thank you both so much. I had mentioned that you'd written one of my favorite works, and it's linked in the show notes. And the work in question was March 2019's paper, Bursting the Bubbles, Russian A2AD in the Baltic Sea Region, which the two of you wrote together with Christopher Berglund. You're going to have to tell me if I mispronounce his name, and I'm sorry if he's listening. I'm going to shift into fanboy mode, though, for just a minute, because I've recommended this work at least 50 times. We use it as a text for the class that I taught on operational art in Germany. It's a really good comprehensive work if you want to understand both the capabilities and the limitations of A2AD. So, Robert, I'll start with you. What is Bursting the Bubble about, and why did you decide to write it?
Well, it's about a critical examination of the Russian A2AD capabilities in light of the hype that was heaped on Russian A2AD capabilities following the Crimea. And it, in a way, it started with, I did a study on air sea battle and Chinese A2AD. So I kind of got on the subject. And then after Crimea, we talked our paymasters into commissioning a study of the A2AD. And by that time, I had a feeling in my knees that there was something wrong with the reporting about Russian capabilities in also the serious mainstream media in the West and in the professional media. So we wanted to go after that story.
Thanks. Michael, before I come to you, just Michael, how did it sounds like Robert sort of started with this project, but how did you become involved with Bursting the Bubble?
Sure. Well, first of all, the study started as a primer for non-specialists trying to explain, intended to be 4 pages long, trying to explain the technical reasons why you shouldn't take Russian claims of the A2AD capability as face value. But the more we dug into it and the more you go contrary, received wisdom, the more you feel a need to sort of justify and explain and verify your claims. And so it grew in size quite substantially. So towards the second half of the writing, I came into the project. And second, I'd just like to add, there's three orders, but at least five, or it's a teamwork beyond that as well. We rely a lot on our technical colleagues and a lot of our Russia team as well. And without that breadth of expertise available to us, I don't think we would have been able to put together such a comprehensive report.
Thank you. Robert, let me come back to you. Did you begin the research with any assumptions?
Yes, I did, that this is a serious matter that needs serious attention. And another assumption was the Earth is round, while radar beams travel in a straight line.
Thank you. And Michael, how about you?
Well, not to start off, but the more you dig into the empirics of it, the more obvious it was that there was quite a big need to revise the received wisdom on Russian capabilities. But it really wasn't a thesis to begin with. We didn't have a point that we wanted to make. It was more that we did the analysis, and once we were done, realized, okay, we probably need to put this up front and to make it clarify what the main takeaway is. But it wasn't the starting assumption. It was the conclusion of the analysis.
Thank you. Robert, I'm going to ask you, you've both mentioned sort of Russian hype around A2AD. Do you believe that that's a Western phenomenon or just Westerners sort of accepting Russian propaganda?
Probably it's a combination that the Russians have reasons to hype their own capabilities, both political reasons, that is scaring Russia, we are mean and bad and strong. And on the Western side, there was, you might say, that the pendulum of assessment of Russia swung from before Crimea, they were generally seen as a basket case. And then after Crimea, they were 10 feet tall. So there were some people in the West who had an interest in driving this story, you might say.
Thank you. So what did you learn about your assumptions as you started to do the research? And were there any real revelations for you? And Robert, we'll start with you and then come to you, Mikhail.
Well, one thing, a revelation, was it's more complicated. As you go below the surface, there are some aspects to it that were really complicated. And then another thing I realized after a while, or Mike and I and Christopher realized, was that in order to explain this to the intelligent layperson, we cannot just zero in missiles and radars and stuff. We have to explain the problem of hitting a moving object at a long distance. So in a way, that's why it kind of turned out like a primer and that annex on hitting a moving target at long distance, because there were some things I remember from my midshipman years, which you couldn't expect the common man or woman in the street to grasp.
I was actually going to ask a follow-up to that. Just how did your background with the coastal artillery help the development of this project?
Well, it gave me a little bit sense of, say, a warning signal. When those maps with 400-kilometer range of the S-400 from Kaliningrad started popping up, I remembered the old teaching about the radar horizon. Hello, there's something hidden here. This can't be right. So it's helped me, and it's helped us that this old background of mine about the in and out of hitting a moving target. And of course, in the coastal artillery, hitting something at 20 kilometers with a cannon wasn't trivial. And then, of course, hitting something at 10 times the distance is also a non-trivial problem.
Mikhail, how about for you then? Any real revelations as you went about the research? Was this the first time that you worked on a project specifically focused on this area?
In terms of our near abroad and conventional military, no. On Russian air defense, yes, I would say so. The revelations were, there was a multitude. One was, as soon as you start scratching the surface, as Robert said, the 400 kilometer rings, not even the proponents of sort of maximalist threats, not even they believe in the 400 kilometer rings, because it's assumed that it's a maximal range of the missile. And it would assume that the target would be moving in a straight line and a very predictable. Second was when we started looking at possible countermeasures and drawing from previous conflicts, and you sort of you tend to look only at your own vulnerabilities. But if you turn around and look at Kaliningrad from a Russian perspective, it's quite vulnerable. And so that was maybe not a revelation, but a shift in perspective was quite helpful.
Yes, and I'd like to add that here, having real Russian specialists and real rocket scientists and radar boffins, you would say in British English, in-house was a great boom, because we could go with them and talk about ideas and get feedback. So it helped make the product better.
Well, this goes directly to my next question, and Mikhail, I'll start with you. How did you go about having some of these discussions about capabilities? Were you able to pare back the range rings to something that looks more manageable for a military planner?
Well, I have a habit which is sometimes irritating for my colleagues. When I get an idea, I go and bother them and talk to them about it. And then it's really good to be able to have rocket scientists and Russian specialists next door. So it was really very informal that I or Michael went over to their office and asked them or sent an email. And it was very much like a chat.
Michael, anything to add on that question?
No, yes. The comparative strength of working in a place like the Swedish Defense Research Agency is having access to these kinds of experts. It is not necessarily we were asking them to do something new. We're just drawing on the expertise that they already had. And it's kind of an iterative process. Even after the study was done and after we did the follow-up conference report and we had some diverging views from some of the authors, we could still go back to them and say, what do you think about this? And is this plausible? And so forth. And just adding 400 kilometers, how should I put it? It's not that we have an alternative number. It's much more complex. It's the range is shorter, but we don't have a definite answer, and it depends on a lot of circumstances. So I don't want to give the impression that one number that gets thrown around is, we say, against low-flying targets, effective range is 20 to 35 kilometers. Sure, there's backup and there's sourcing for that claim, but it's not like it's that small either. We don't want to underestimate the capabilities either.
Well, let me ask you, obviously I'm a fan of this, and I sort of live in an online bubble where these things get talked about, but what has been the response to this?
Sure. It's very, very encouraging, both the informal and the formal responses. It was the single most downloaded and read report. We followed what happened to it. It was like translated. The news about it was translated to 15 languages within a couple of days. We received an invitation to DSEI, the air power section, lots of encouraging emails. Of course, not, you know, if you say something partly new and partly controversial, not everyone is persuaded 100% straight away, but it's been very, very encouraging. Like, we realize over time that we might have helped change the debate on Russian A280 capabilities towards something more constructive and more narrowing in on the unknowns, and moving from the sort of exaggerated view and hopefully avoiding being too dismissive. So, but overall, it's been a very positive experience. I also think that the follow-up report that we did shows this, that people talk about this and think about the problem from a different, a more constructive angle now than they did just a couple of years ago. And we're not the only reason why, but hopefully we sort of contributed to this shift.
Yes, and just one follow-up question there. What is DSCI that you referenced?
It's the main the military conference in London, but the Robert, help me out here. It's defense, security, something.
Defense, systems, technology. It's a huge expo that in the end of August, early September, every year. So a huge expo filled with all kinds of military gear. People come from all over the world to feel and touch. And then there are seminars. So when we were invited to speak at that, my boss got, that conference, it's really high class.
Thank you. Robert, how's the response been from your perspective?
Absolutely overwhelming. In 30 years at FOI, I have never helped produce a report that has gotten this response. And we've been invited, as we said, to London, to also to Chevenham, and a U.S. think tank paid for me to fly over to the U.S. and present it to people from the Pentagon. And I must say, I feel a little bit like the little boy in Hans Christian Andersen's story about the emperor's new clothes, because I've been telling them that the Earth is round. And it has been known for 500 years, but still, I think our report helped break the spell.
So, yeah, I had a follow-up directly to that. It's about NATO behavior, but I guess I should change the language a little bit, because you're from Sweden. Finland is another non-aligned country who would have, I think, intense interest in the subject. But have you noticed any changes in NATO behavior as a result of this, or within Sweden or Finland? And Robert, I'll ask you to start.
Not really, but on the other hand, we don't watch NATO behavior or Swedish naval behavior that closely. But what I have seen is that a lot of people in the Swedish Navy and within NATO have been relieved that we have removed this feeling that, it's so terrible. Russia commands almost the whole of the Baltic because of its missiles. So there's been a sense of relief on the part of admirals and commodores I've talked to.
Mikael, generally agree with that assessment, or have you seen anything different?
No, I agree fully with that assessment. We don't follow that closely. We wouldn't be privy, but we notice from the way people talk about this and the way from the open publications and so forth that there's been a shift in approach to the problem.
Yeah, I would say that's been my biggest takeaway, is the way that people discuss it before and after. I don't want to overstate it, but it is a pretty dramatic shift. And people were almost afraid to discuss operations in the Baltic beforehand, and now it's accepted that there will be some cost to operating there, but it can be done. And it's just a question of what kind of units and how you would do it. Robert, I'm going to ask, was there any negative feedback, and then how did you deal with that?
A little bit. There was some murmuring that we devalued the threat. And there were also a couple of voices who had been of the maximalist persuasion that were not too happy with our study and tried to piece together a Russian capability to hit targets very far away nonetheless. But they have really been marginal.
Can I ask what you mean by maximalist? That's just the first time I've encountered that description.
I think it's Michael's term, but those that interpret Russian capabilities as being everything the Russians say and then some.
Yeah, I can add to that. It's just assuming everything works as advertised, the 400-kilometer range, everything is deployed, any sensor, any shooter, kind of network, and also perfect jointness between different part of the Navy and so forth, and the Navy and the Army and so forth. So just assuming everything works perfectly, as we know full well, it never does in our own sort of armed forces. So that's the maximalist version of it.
No, thank you. That's a great explanation. Michael, I'm going to come back to you. When did you start planning the sequel to this?
Well, actually, we had a sense that this might be a big thing. So first, we published this, and then just 5 days later, we published an op-ed in Foreign Policy. And then we had sort of a list of presentations of the study for, you know, for the Defense Department and the Armed Forces Headquarters and so forth. And then as soon as that was done, after a couple of weeks, we applied for a grant to have the conference, so within a few weeks. And this stems from the sense that it's such a complex and broad subject. It involves all three domains and arguably should involve additional, such as cyber and so forth, and even non-military. And then it moves from the very technical to the very sort of security politics. So we had a sense that we did, it was an accomplishment to sort of cover all of that ground. We didn't feel that we had enough granularity in certain areas. So that's why we wanted to dig deeper and hear what the best people in the respective fields had to say.
And then, Michael, I'll come back to you for the next question. You have what we would call in English a murderer's row of talent, just a very accomplished group of people to write Beyond the Bubbles from all over Northern Europe, and you snuck in a few Americans as well. Did you pick topics and then look for authors, or did you choose authors and then allow them to seek out a topic they enjoyed?
Sure, a bit of both. So we looked at sort of five or six areas that we wanted to cover in greater detail, and we managed to cover all of them except for sort of lessons learned from the Israeli air campaign in Syria that turned out to be too sensitive. But beyond that, we picked the topics, and then we contacted the top people that we knew of. But within each topic, such as, you know, naval operations or air operations or non-military, they had very free rein to sort of formulate their own questions and their own topics within that broader framework. So it was a balance between the two of them.
Thanks. And the next question, Robert, I'll ask you is, your credit as editors for Beyond the Bubbles, and it's a little bit more of an anthology series for those who haven't read it. That'll be linked in the show notes as well. But what were you trying to achieve with Beyond the Bubbles? We've sort of already talked about the goal for the first article.
Well, first of all, I think it's a sound military principle, reinforce success. And secondly, we were trying to get an outside view on our analysis. Where did we go wrong? What did we miss? Thirdly, we wanted to have a wider perspective and also to try to pinpoint the areas where there was still uncertainty that needed further work.
Did you think any of the authors identified a place where you, quote-unquote, went wrong?
Oh, good one. I think that...
Let me jump in and caveat here. It's like, we're not trying to critique any of the authors. I'm just...
No. I think we may, in the original study, as we had to keep the volume down. It was originally a 4-page primer and it became a 120-page report. We had to focus on a few systems, S-400, the Bastion system, etc., the Iskander, and didn't take in the full breadth of all the other systems that they have in a similar category. Nor did we discuss in depth the potential for connecting shooter and sensor above service lines. But we did that then in the second report.
And then, Robert, let me ask you, and then I'll go back to Mikhail, but were there any of the pieces that surprised you?
Elements in the pieces, yes, but none of the pieces as such, except pleasant surprises, of course.
Mikhail, how about you?
Yeah, I'm thinking about it. I think it's a hard question to answer because we read each chapter probably 10 times by now. So by now it feels very familiar. But of course, they added elements of knowledge and expertise that we didn't have. But and like Robert said, it was more of broadening the scope and being sort of giving full representing the complexity of the issues at hand. But of course, we learned tons, and some people had divergent views, and some were more optimistic than we are, and some were more pessimistic. But it was the greatest takeaway from me was that reasonable people, even of slightly different persuasion, see eye to eye on a number of things concerning Russian A280 capabilities, which is narrowing the scope to the few genuine areas of uncertainty. So I think that was very helpful.
Mikhail, did you have I'm not going to ask you to pick a least favorite, but did you have a favorite contribution from the chapters that you received?
There were several. Keir Giles, I think, was excellent in the sense that it took a totally non-military perspective. From a Swedish perspective, I thought Robin Hegblom, his take on air defense and different solutions for the Russian long-range precision strike regime was very helpful. But I could probably list all of them. I think they were really good, but in various ways.
And Robert, how about you? Did you have a particular contribution that you enjoyed more than the others?
No, really. It was like a smorgasbord or one of those Chinese dinners where you have a little bit of each pieces. No, I can't say I had one favorite, but I have several favorite pieces in different articles.
So then, Robert, let me come back to you and ask, do you have anything else planned for this series?
Oh, yes and no. We plan, we have an article planned, but Michael can talk about that. And we will probably look at some scenarios for the Swedish government, but that will probably not be published. Michael, you can talk about the article.
Yes, the bullet point on our communications list we still haven't checked off is writing a sort of policy-oriented article based on the summarizing what we learned so far. So we're working on that. Beyond that, I think it will be a little bit of event-driven. Depending on what happens in our near abroad, we might pick up the thread again, but we're not planning another conference in the near future, at least. Not for now.
Yeah, I think.
But I think there are two issue areas which stand out as being in need of work. One is a much more fine-grained look at the Russian IADS system. Now, some writers tend to assume that Russia has a single IADS. We have come to the conclusion that they probably have three. One for the Air Force, one for the Army, one for the Navy. But as to how interconnected they are, I think we can do some work there. And the second issue area, which I think merits a closer look, is the things we've seen come out of the Middle East. Because the spectacular failure of Russian-made equipment in Syria and Libya, Israeli, but also against Turkish opponents, begs a further look. We know that Russian air defense systems work and can shut down airliners, but how much of a threat are they to military aircraft?
Well, let me ask you, have you given any thought to picking up this question and transporting it to another area geographically? You mentioned that this sort of stemmed from a lot of the conversation that started happening after Crimea. Has there been any thought given to taking this to the Black Sea, or is the fact that you happen to work for a Swedish institution kind of limit this to the scope of the geographic area where you're going to look at this problem?
Well, we'll see what kind of invitations come to us after beyond bursting bubble has, so to say, settled, because the speaking invitations we got from the first report, they arrived 3 months or 6 months after the report had come out. So I won't say never, ever, but of course, our paymasters want us to focus our attention on areas closer to home. What happens in the Black Sea is, of course, also an interest to Sweden.
Well, thank you very much. Unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for today. I'd like to thank my guest, Robert Dalzio, Mikael Jonsson. Robert, where can we find you online and what are you working on next?
I'm on Twitter. And then almost all our published reports are at FOI's homepage. That's foi.se. And right now we're working like beavers on a major report due out around New Year's on Western military capabilities.
Thank you. And Michael, how about you? Where can we find you online and what are you working on?
I'm working on the same major report on Western military capabilities. And so Robert is working on convincing me to join Twitter. I think I will eventually. Sorry, I'm really slow at this.
No, you're okay. I highly recommend Twitter. You just have to curate your list very carefully to avoid the garbage fires. But thank you again to both my guests, and thanks to the listeners for tuning in. We'll see you next week. Sea Control is edited and produced by Keegan Ingersoll, Ed Salo, and William McQuiston. Shimona.